Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Jenna Dooley, in this week for Sean Crawford. On the way, what to know about a new effort to make college in Illinois more affordable. Western Illinois University has changed the title of its interim president, and we'll hear from the institution's 13th president. The Illinois State Flag Commission has picked 10 possible finalists for a new state flag. Design elements range from Abraham Lincoln's silhouette to green stripes representing rows of crops. The commission, made up of artists, historians, and teachers, received nearly 5,000 entries, and we'll hear some of the inspiration behind one of the finalist designs. Finally, communities across the country and the world recently celebrated Mexico's patron saint. We'll hear highlights from one celebration held in Northern Illinois. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. You've likely heard about how expensive college has gotten. Maybe you're putting a huge chunk of your paycheck towards student loan payments, or you're wondering how you'll afford to send your kids to college. What you may not know is the problem is especially bad in Illinois. And now a group of politicians and advocates in the state have a pretty revolutionary plan to change that. WBEZ's Lisa Kurian Phillip breaks down how it would work.
The name of the legislation is extremely unsexy. It has words like adequate and equitable in it. But people like Christian Perry are psyched about what it could do. He's from the advocacy group Partnership for College Completion.
Even if you have, you know, younger babies like yourself or a teenager like I do, the point of this work is to ensure that, you know, they enter into a different higher education landscape than the one that you and I inherited.
The one that he and I inherited, it sucks. And that's in part because Illinois has no system for how it funds its public universities. College leaders just go to Springfield to beg for money and cross their fingers they get it. And they often have not. Since 2000, state spending on higher education has been cut in half. That's right, half. It used to be that state funding made up most of a public university's revenue. Now, schools have to rely on tuition for the majority of their money.
The state disinvestment has created pressures for these universities to raise their tuition to levels that their student populations just could not afford.
Mike Abramson is a researcher at the Partnership for College Completion.
They really put them in an impossible spot.
So how are legislators trying to fix it? With math. They want to use a formula to distribute funds. It would calculate the minimum each school needs to educate the particular kinds of students it serves. More money would be set aside for low-income, first-generation, and racially marginalized students. Researcher Nick Lee says the formula would take Illinois from one of the worst at funding higher education to a model for other states to emulate.
I think it does a great job of lifting up and shedding light on the fact of it costs different amounts of money to educate different students and to educate them in different programs at different institution types.
Okay, this all sounds super wonky. So let's talk about what this might look like in real life. I want to take you to Chicago State University on the city's south side. It's the only public university in Illinois with a predominantly Black student body. Christian Perry, that first guy you heard from, he grew up nearby.
A parent now with a 7-year-old maybe wouldn't look at Chicago State because of if they drove past it, you know, they see a stop sign that might be crooked and, you know, a little bit of flooding due to the bad infrastructure.
Over the years, the state has put less and less money into the school, and Chicago State's students aren't able to pay much more to make up the difference. Most come from families that qualify as low income. That's meant their college has fewer resources to serve students. That's meant fewer students are enrolling, which has meant fewer tuition dollars. It's a downward spiral. Perry says if the formula is done right, the school could be restored to what it was like when his grandfather went there in the 70s.
10 years from now, that campus could look radically different. It could be buzzing and humming with more students, where you might feel a little bit more comfortable trying to strong arm your baby to stay home, right? And go to Chicago State because the amenities and what they can offer.
The problem is, this would all be really expensive. Researchers estimate that fully funding the formula will require jacking up higher education spending by $1.4 billion in taxpayer dollars over the next decade. But Abramson, the researcher, says the payoff would be many times that. because people with college degrees can contribute more to the local economy.
In the short view of this, the funding piece is hard, right? In the long view, every other thing that we fund, that our state funds, will be hard without it.
Abramson estimates students who get college degrees as a result would pay more than $6 billion in state taxes over their lifetimes. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
Western Illinois University no longer has an interim president. Western's board voted unanimously to name Christy Mindrup as the institution's 13th president. Rich Egger reports.
Mindrup had served as interim president since April 1st. She replaced Guiyu Wong, who left before his contract was up. Board chairperson Karen Stutz says since then, Mindrup proved to be the right leader for Western.
Is there a better vetting process than seeing someone actually do the job for 8 months?
Mindrup is Western's first female president in its 125-year history. She says she's received a lot of support since April.
You're the reason I'm sitting here, all of you in this room right now. You're the reason why I would consider doing this role back on April 1st. You're the reason I would consider doing it now in December.
Board members and others at the meeting gave Mindrup a standing ovation after the vote, but not everyone was happy with the outcome. Merrill Cole is president of Western's chapter of the University Professionals of Illinois, which represents faculty.
I take this as another example of the board simply bypassing shared governance.
Cole says he has nothing against Mindrup, but is disappointed with the process. He says the decision felt rushed. Trustee Derek Wise headed a committee to assess a presidential appointment. It conducted surveys that included input from faculty and other constituencies.
People had a chance to speak that wanted to participate, and that was the goal, participation.
Board members say the survey was not scientific, but it did help take the temperature in the room. Board Vice Chairperson Polly Radosh is a former Western faculty member and says she is an advocate for faculty, but she feels they are wrong to want a national presidential search done.
In my opinion, it would be foolish to push aside the first president in 5 years who has had the courage and insight to make the bold decisions that the board has been asking for. She's doing an exceptional job. She has excelled.
Radosh says during her 5 years on the board, Western has hired a president, two provosts, four vice presidents, and two deans, all through national searches.
And two of those people are still on campus. Two. We have a terrible record in national searches. We have serious problems facing the university. And people hired in national searches have not solved them in my 5 years on the board.
Radosh says Western has made progress in resolving its financial problems since April, which she attributed to Mindrup and her leadership team. Mindrup says her grandparents and an aunt showed her Western when she was a child and inspired her love for the university.
On a personal note, I so deeply care about Western Illinois University. It's in my blood.
Mindrup began her career at Western in 1997 when the university opened its Quad Cities campus in the IBM building in Moline. She started out as a clerk, answering phones at night and on weekends. Through the years, Mindrup has worked her way up through the ranks and was vice president of Quad Cities campus operations before being named interim president. Details of her contract are still being negotiated, but it will run through the end of June 2027.
Tri-State's Public Radio's Rich Egger talked with Mindrup after the board meeting.
Now that you are no longer an interim, you are president, will you start removing interim from other people's titles?
Yeah, we'll start looking at our leadership as well as other levels of the organization. It's partly about titles. It's also partly about ensuring that we have the right leadership for the institution. And so certainly our goal is to stabilize our staffing and our administration so that we can continue to move forward and advance the institution at that level.
What have you learned from being interim that you can now apply to being president?
My immediate responsibility was to understand the needs of the institution, to understand the urgent needs, as well as to start to conceptualize how we as a university want to carry the institution forward. And so I think what I've learned during my time as an interim president is there is just such a strong desire by this university community to see our university be successful so we can continue to serve students. And I would also add that I think there's deep passion and desire to be involved in the process. And so while we needed to move so quickly to address our initial crisis, we now have a little bit more latitude to be able to be more intentional about having inclusive conversations with our students, with our faculty, staff, and our different stakeholder groups, so that we can really together continue the great mission of the university to advance us and move us forward.
Are we looking at more layoffs coming in the spring? Do we know yet?
We are assessing our financial picture. Most recently, we've gathered further information about some of the early state projections, and so it's important to build those into our equation. We're doing that now. We're looking at where we are with enrollment. So far, we're where we predicted we would be this spring semester. So we planned for a little bit more continued decline because of the enrollment cliff. We're also continuing to plan, I always like to emphasize when I say that, for ways that we can grow as well. As far as our financial picture, we'll be getting together with stakeholder groups to identify the ways that we can further address our cash flow situation that becomes challenging this spring.
Will there be programs that are eliminated or severely reduced?
Yeah, universities ongoing, not just during financial crisis, should be looking at their programs. And so the university is evaluating some programs based on their, on their viability, on their efficiency, on the demand from students and their enrollment. And so these are things that we should be doing not just during financially challenging times, but ongoing. And I think it will be even more required of institutions of the future to increasingly be agile, to align resources for programs that are in high demand, as well as for those programs that we know as an institution really impact student learning, student development while they're students at WIU.
That's Christy Mindrup, who's been named the 13th president of Western Illinois University. She's worked at Western for more than 27 years and spoke with Tri-State's Public Radio's Rich Egger. An oral history project that launched at Northern Illinois University is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Maria Gardner-Lara shares why the collection of Latino voices may be more relevant in the current political climate.
Oral history is about documenting the experience of folks often left out of the historical record. So the letters, diaries, and speeches of famous historical figures have likely been preserved.
We have those for like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Simon Bolivar, right? So like Jose Marti, right? These prominent leaders and thinkers. But oral histories allow us to capture the stories, the experiences, the perspectives of everyday, ordinary people.
That's NIU professor Christina Abreu. She's a director of the NIU Center for Latino and Latin American Studies. She also leads NIU's Latinx Oral History Project. The project collects and preserves the stories of everyday Latinos. It began in 2014 and contains over 300 interviews.
The focus really at that time was on capturing, documenting the experiences of undocumented individuals in the area, of immigration stories in the area.
Since then, the collection's scope has widened to stories of Latinos involved in politics, community organizing, and those in the teaching profession.
Really, we're centered in capturing the stories and making more visible the presence and the contributions of Latinos in this area.
The collection also includes over 50 oral histories of Latinos impacted in the first year of the pandemic.
A lot of those stories really capture how Latino healthcare workers, for example, like what their experiences were. What was it like working in a nursing home? What was it like working in a hospital?
Here's a sample of an interview conducted in 2020. The interviewee is an NIU graduate a registered nurse, and a DACA recipient. She recalls trying to convince a construction worker suffering from COVID to stay for treatment.
It was this difficult situation of him like picking between his health and then his livelihood. And I wanted him to understand that you can't have a livelihood without a life, you know? But he was very much like adamant about leaving and going to work, unfortunately.
Alexandra Alcantar is a first-year NIU law student and an interviewer on the Oral History Project. She's currently speaking with Latino leaders of higher education. Previously, she interviewed NIU undergraduate students of mixed-status families that she conducted as part of her honors thesis. Participants were given aliases to protect their family members with varying legal status. She finds involvement in the project is beneficial to both the interviewer and interviewee.
I think it gives them a big amount of power for themselves, but it also gives me a lot of, like, being appreciative that someone feels comfortable saying this and that they feel comfortable about their story being out there.
The project was awarded over $300,000 by the National Endowment for the Humanities to digitize the collection, and they're partnering with NIU libraries to complete the work. The project director anticipates the initiative to wrap up in 2 years. Abreu says the grant is a big deal.
Now we have this tremendous opportunity to give folks online access to this like treasure of information and stories that are otherwise not available anywhere else.
When asked the project's relevance in light of an anti-Latino, anti-immigrant political climate, Abreu says it stands against false rhetoric about the community's presence in the area.
On the one hand, right, it's about combating or posing a challenge to erasure.
She says the stories give substance to Latinos' long history in the Midwest and their contribution as leaders, as workers, and as neighbors. She says the stories may also help generate empathy.
Sharing people's hopes and dreams and contributions and family life, you know, school life, and trying to counter maybe some of the more harmful narratives that are floating out there and showcasing the real richness and depth of the Latino presence in the area.
Stay with us. Statewide continues. Welcome back to Statewide. Secret FBI recordings in the trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan are outlining the anatomy of the alleged Chinatown corruption scheme. Government mole Danny Solis got Madigan to push legislation that would have turned over a state-owned parking lot to developers. If the deal had gone through, the alleged expectation was the developers would steer tax work to Madigan's law firm. Dave McKinney has more.
I'm looking at a parking lot at a busy intersection in Chicago's Chinatown neighborhood. This parking lot is a prime piece of property. You might not realize that its owner is the state of Illinois. Developers had their eye on turning it into much more than a parking lot, but it would take a lot of maneuvering to sell the land for them to build a hotel. And that maneuvering has played out in dramatic fashion at the corruption trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan.
I might want to talk to you afterwards on an issue in Chinatown where we need a transference of property from the state to the city.
That July 2017 back and forth between government mole Danny Solis and Madigan is one of the many secret FBI recordings Solis made of conversations with the then speaker.
If you might have heard of it before, it's the Chinatown parking lot on Wentworth and Cermak.
The parking lot next to the Red Line is where customers to many of Chinatown's famed restaurants and shops park for as little as $2 for 3 hours. It's operated by a not-for-profit that splits proceeds from the lot with local businesses. Many Chinatown residents opposed the plan to return the parking lot into a hotel and storefronts. State Representative Teresa Ma was a freshman legislator representing Chinatown, and when details of the project became public, her constituents told her how much the parking lot helped the community, so she tried to stop it. In doing so, she got an education in what an alleged greased deal might look like.
There were a lot of attempts at backroom deals that the public wasn't aware of, and that folks are now just coming to hear about, and it was swirling around me.
Here's how it all went down and how Madigan allegedly tried to cover his tracks. Solis was at the center of it, working as an FBI mole because he had gotten himself into trouble. He was alderman of the ward where the parking lot is located and knew the city's big developers, whose projects often needed his backing as chair of the City Council Zoning Committee. Madigan allegedly pushed Solis repeatedly to arrange meetings with developers to drum up lucrative tax work for his law firm. And the sales pitches, like this one from the then speaker himself, often worked.
We don't take a second seat to anybody in terms of the quality and the results that we get.
While Solis is wearing a wire, developers approached him about the Chinatown parking lot project and their hopes to turn it into a hotel. But the parking lot was state-owned, and it would take legislation in Springfield to make the deal happen. So the FBI told Solis, ask Madigan to help get it passed, with the understanding the reward would be possible legal work from the developers. As the two talked, Madigan drew up a plan. He would make the deal happen. He just wanted the developers, though, to meet his guy.
What you want to do is to convince the state to turn that over to the city.
Correct.
All right, so you tell me which one, Ray Chin or the other guy. I'd like them to talk to a man named Mike McLean.
Mike McLean, the second defendant in this trial, has known Madigan for decades as a one-time House colleague and later a lobbyist. After McLean retired, Madigan began giving him sensitive assignments, a role prosecutors say was vital to keeping what they called a vast Madigan criminal enterprise afloat. So Solis goes to meet McLean, explains the contours of the Chinatown project, and then says if they're successful in getting it done in Springfield, their mutual friend, the speaker, will benefit. Solis had done things like that before that helped Madigan financially.
In the past, I have been able to steer some work to Mike, and these guys will do the same thing.
McLean did not object to the idea of a potential payday for Madigan if the strategy of passing something in 2018 succeeded. Solis tells Madigan multiple times, including on this wiretap, the same thing, that the Chinatown hotel developers likely would use his tax firm if he could pass the legislation that they needed. Again, there was no hint of objection.
If you can take care of that matter in May, I'm confident they'll appreciate it and sign you up on after May.
Okay, right.
Very good. All right. Thanks
again.
All right, Mike. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Their efforts began hitting roadblocks, including from state transportation officials, Ma, and Democrats in the state Senate. But Madigan and McLean, they kept pushing. Near the end of the 2018 legislative session, McLean calls a Madigan staff member working on the Chinatown land transfer bill. McLean relays a message from the speaker himself. Madigan didn't want a record of his own support for the plan. It was a sign, prosecutors said, that Madigan knew he might make money off the deal, yet wanted his involvement in passing the legislation to be secret. Here's McLean talking with the staffer.
Right. That deals with the developer of his, and so he wants to make sure he votes present.
Right.
But the deal stalled that spring. By fall, Madigan pitched a new idea to McLean to break the logjam, handing the parking lot land transfer bill off to another legislator. But that tactic didn't materialize either, and as opposition in Chinatown intensified, Solis tells Madigan that the legislation should just wait.
So I think we might have to hold it off till maybe May.
That might have remained the script, except Solis's cover as a mole soon got blown by a Chicago Sun-Times report that he'd been wearing a wire. Now, 5 years later, Ma is closely watching the Madigan and McLean trial, and she says she's proud of her role in thwarting what she called corrupt schemes surrounding the parking lot deal. It's like a badge of honor to her.
That's what I'm in this job for, you know, not to enrich or benefit, you know, people who don't care about my constituents, who care more about themselves.
Soon, it'll be up to a jury to decide whether that's what really happened here, and whether a man once regarded as Illinois' most powerful politician and one of his dearest friends should go to federal prison.
In the prosecution phase of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan and co-defendant Michael McLean's federal corruption trial, jurors heard from about 50 witnesses and digested more than 190 secret FBI recordings submitted by the government since October. In Illinois, local law enforcement can't collaborate with federal immigration officials when they try to enforce immigration laws, including deportations. WBEZ's immigration reporter Adriana Cardona McGee God spoke with Mary Dixon to explain more about the policies.
Illinois has nearly a half million undocumented immigrants, plus thousands of recently arrived migrants. And many of the, a lot of these people live in mixed status homes and are integrated into our communities. I talk to a lot of people out there on the field, and a lot of these undocumented residents, they want a path to legal status in the country, but because they enter the country legally, there's really not a lot of options for them. So these sanctuary laws help protect undocumented immigrants from being criminalized or targeted by local police. Also, it really builds relations between police and immigrant communities.
There are limits to what sanctuary laws can do, though. Can you walk us through them?
Yeah, there is one big limit here. City and state officials can't prevent ICE agents from enforcing federal immigration law on their own. ICE agents could bypass these and rely on intimidating strategies like illegal traffic stops, and those are tactics they tried in the past.
President-elect Trump has promised mass deportations on day one of his new administration. Would Chicago and Illinois sanctuary laws help to protect against that?
Under these local laws, ICE enforcement efforts can be limited, but again, not entirely prevented. We don't know how massive these deportation efforts can be because of a lack of manpower at the federal level, but Trump recently confirmed plans to declare a national emergency and use the U.S. military to assist with mass deportations. And to do that, he could invoke the Insurrection Act, which gives the president emergency powers to use federal troops on domestic soil to curb local unrest. But it'll get challenged in court.
The number of hunters in the U.S. has been on the decline since the 1980s. White men still represent the majority of hunters, but many Midwest states and outdoor organizations are trying to reach groups that haven't historically participated in hunting. Teresa Holmesy reports women represent a growing demographic of hunters.
It's Michigan's opening day of the deer firearm season, and Charlene Goronsky is decked out in camo. We hear gunshots nearby, but don't see any deer. After 50 years of hunting, Goronsky knows that it takes patience. She shot her first rabbit when she was just 12 years old with her Uncle Bob.
That was our special thing.
Goronsky says she doesn't know for sure why her uncle chose her instead of her brothers or sisters. But she suspects he noticed blood and guts didn't bother her.
I think that was part of it because he didn't like to clean the animals. Yeah, he was squeamish. Yes, and I wasn't.
In its first ever national survey on outdoor recreation from 1955, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reported that roughly 4% of hunters were women. That number has climbed to around 22%. But the gender gap is still pretty wide.
Whether that has to do with it being a traditionally male-dominated field or just lack of representation, women get intimidated by the subject matter.
Jess Rice is the founder of Wilderness. That's with an H. It's an organization that began in Missouri and hosts regular events for women to get together and hunt. Rice grew up hunting and knows how empowering it can be.
All I've ever wanted out of this is to show people what this incredible world has to offer us. Because all of it, at the end of the day, relates back to conservation.
Many states want more female hunters and see them as an untapped market. That's because a smaller percentage of Americans hunt today compared to 50 years ago. And hunting licenses provide a lot of funding for conservation programs in the U.S. Fewer hunters can also hurt wildlife management. Swanee Evans is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says 33% of new entrants are women, but that's not having as big of a long-term shift on who hunts.
Females in general, they don't tend to hunt as consistently. They tend to be a little bit less avid. And then they have a tendency to drop out more.
In surveys, Evan says women report a lack of time and access to public land as the top barriers, as well as intimidation and safety concerns. Rice, the founder of Wilderness, says for a lot of women, childcare takes up their free time.
We have found offering mom and me opportunities is another way to help those experiences stick. Because if mama gets on board, typically the rest of the family is going to get on board.
Rice and other women say a safe, non-competitive environment is important to build confidence among female hunters. Rachel Alice coordinates the Becoming an Outdoors Woman program through the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. The organization, with chapters in most states, hosts workshops for women to learn the ropes and feel less overwhelmed, like when buying hunting equipment.
The whole focus is to just create a pretty inviting space where like-minded ladies can ask those questions, like, how did you go up to that gun counter?
Alice says she had to overcome her own reservations about hunting. She was a vegetarian for more than a decade before she moved to the Midwest. Then 5 years ago, a coworker invited her to go hunting.
There was a lot of soul searching. Can I identify as this? Can I put on social media to my vegetarian East Coast friends that I did this thing?
But Alice says she got excited about harvesting fresh meat for friends and family. And now she's helping other women do the same. Back in Michigan, Charlene Goronsky says she taught her daughter to hunt, who is now in turn teaching her daughter. Goronsky says her granddaughter will happily shoot her crossbow while wearing a poofy princess dress.
And she's really a girly girl, but she likes to do that stuff too, so.
Goronsky says passing on her knowledge brings her pride as a mom, grandma, and a hunter. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Teresa Homsey.
Basketball leagues for young Muslim girls are springing up around the Chicago area. They're encouraging more girls to get into sports while celebrating their Muslim identity. Anna Savchenko picks up the story from the sidelines.
I'm at a Park District gym in suburban Woodridge, where a dozen teen girls are warming up for basketball practice, currently doing defensive drills.
It's 1-2, now I push, now I roll this way.
The girls stop mid-practice for a water break, and some of them put on their hoodies and line up in the middle of the court with their shoes off and kneel down in prayer. They're joined in prayer by some of their parents and their coach, Amina Chaudhry. For the girls, the scene is routine, but it's symbolic of a major shift among Muslim girls in the Chicago area, where a growing number of them are getting into sports like basketball. Here's Coach Chaudhry.
We have girls in our program who had never even thought about playing basketball, never picked up a basketball a day in their life. But they saw the marketing for a program in the mosque, and it's for girls, and they brought their parents brought them out, and they realized the athletic ability that they have and the basketball talent they have.
One catalyst is a 2021 law that allows Illinois students to modify their sports clothing in schools without needing a waiver from their school district. For Muslim girls, that means they no longer need to get permission to wear a hijab or leggings and long sleeves underneath their uniforms to practice modesty, which is core to their faith.
Ariana's the one right there in the middle with the white, pink, and blue shoes on.
Shamsa Jaffrey sits in the bleachers watching her daughter's practice. She says the change in state law removes a barrier that she faced as a kid.
It wasn't even heard of in like sports to be able to wear clothing or wear a uniform that would align with our religion.
But some young girls are still getting questioned about their clothing choices, like 14-year-old Noreen Mukta. When she started playing in a Park District basketball league in the northwest suburbs 3 years ago, she got asked,
like, why I wear leggings? Like, do I get hot? Like, when I was fasting, and they're like, oh, can't you just cheat? Like, I commend you because I would totally cheat.
Her dad, Janaid, heard similar stories from other parents. So a few of them got together and formed a basketball league for their girls. They called it Muslima Ballers, and they turned to their local mosque in Morton Grove to recruit some 70 players. Dads volunteered to coach, Janaid included, even though his three daughters were all on different teams.
If I was coaching one, that means I 50% chance I was coaching against another, so I tried to avoid coaching, because then there would be problems back at home if I coached one.
Sana, Noreen's mom, wishes leagues like this existed when she was a kid in public school and wasn't allowed to cover up.
I asked the coach once, you know, can I wear sweatpants? And he was like, no, you have to wear shorts. And that's when I just completely, I didn't even ask twice. I didn't have that confidence.
She says it's rewarding to see her daughter do something she wasn't able to.
I mean, she plays confidently, and it makes me very proud. Sometimes when I see her, I'm actually, like, in tears because you don't see girls go that far.
Noreen now plays on her high school basketball team, and Sana credits the league for helping Noreen find the words and the courage to explain to those who ask why she chooses to cover up. Noreen looks up to Bilqis Abdul Qadir, a Muslim American basketball player who was the first NCAA Division I player to wear hijab while competing.
She like really promotes playing with hijab. I'm like, for me, I'm not ready for that yet, but it's something I aspire to be able to do.
Stay with us. Statewide will return right after this. You're listening to Statewide. The Illinois State Flag Commission has picked 10 possible finalists for the state's new flag design. One of the 10 finalist designs for a new state flag came out of the minds of a Bloomington Normal native and two Illinois State University graduates. Colleen Hayes grew up in the Twin Cities, and her family has roots in Gridley. Scott Clannon heads Clannon Creative in Champaign, which submitted the design. In this interview with WGLT's Charlie Schlenker, Clannon and Hayes say they perked up when the state announced the formation of a committee to come up with a new flag. They got excited about the opportunity when the commission announced a contest.
Our current state flag is over 100 years old, and it certainly served its purpose. We have a lot of respect for the flag. As a design agency, we look at it from a designer's eye, and it just it has a kind of an older, outdated feel to it, and it doesn't really fully symbolize the entire state. So we set up to design something that we felt better represented the state of Illinois with the different symbolisms and meanings that we put into it.
What is outdated? What has become obsolete?
Yeah, if you look at other recent state flags that have been redesigned, it's going to more of a minimal, a type approach. And so it's almost say less is more. Our current state flag has a lot of details in it, very small, fine details that make it very challenging to put on anything else outside of just a flag. And so we went with these bold, modern colors, and again, just kind of bold symbolism to represent, again, the different regions within Illinois.
The flag has three stars, a sunrise, and a number of rows. Colleen, what made you do that?
I was just inspired by the idea of creating a flag that could unite everyone in Illinois, no matter where they're from or what their background is. And by showing the three regions of the state and also just kind of honoring our heritage and what Illinois is.
With the three regions, just to add to that too, the northern, central, and southern Illinois. So that's why you see the three stars. And so we wanted to make sure, regardless of where you lived, everyone felt represented in this design. The holistic approach, I think, is more of, you know, blending all the different elements together and celebrating our heritage through the different points and the number of rows that we have.
Colleen, talk a little bit about the rows and what went into that.
There's 21 rows, which is for being the 21st state. And then we have 18 points of the stars, which is when Illinois became the state. We were 18.
What's with the sun?
The sun is to also bring our current flag into this design. It's seen on our current state flag, and I thought it'd be a nice addition to it. So it's not completely redoing. It's also just elevating it and bringing it to a modern time.
We really wanted to emphasize agriculture. So that's why you see that symbol that does represent corn, soybeans, again, agriculture, to celebrate, you know, our rich history, you know, the heart of Illinois, and I think the over 70,000 farming families across the state. So we wanted to make sure that farming and agriculture was a big part of this new design.
Talk about your composition process. Would you, how many iterations did you go through? How many different thought patterns did you come up with before you landed on this one?
There was a lot of different ideas and different options I had gone through. At first, I had it in like a badge similar to on our current state flag, the Eagles holding. I had it with 5-pointed stars, more rows in the field, and then also some less. It's went through a lot of editing and narrowing down.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Colleen Hayes and Scott Clannon, designers for one of the images that is a finalist for New State Flag. How long does a flag stay relevant? This one is more than a century old, so obviously not. But how long does a cultural moment last?
You know, I think it really depends on use case. I know there have been some other state flag designs that have really stood the test of time because they are so simple and timeless. I think that's another key trait or a key thing that we want to look at when we're designing really anything, whether it be a brand, or in this case, a flag, is this a timeless design? And I think that's the issue with our current state flag. You know, it reads a little institutional. It certainly is a seal. How many of us have the flag printed on a t-shirt that we proudly wear, you know, on other type of materials or hanging in front of our house? Not a ton. You know, when you compare it to Texas, Texas is very, very proud of their flag. And you see that symbol everywhere because it's so easily recognizable from any distance.
Colleen, what are some other states that have examples of best practices that you really liked that you took the sensibility of in designing the Illinois one?
So I was inspired by Utah and Minnesota's new flag designs. I thought those really represented what modern flag practices and designs should follow. States that have those more simple, bold flags that don't have a ton of detail on them, but are easily recognizable.
If you get picked, is this a help to the business as well as to your rep and personal satisfaction?
We'll say, yeah, it's certainly bragging rights. I know there are a lot of conversations online about the state flag being redesigned and tax dollars. I do want to make it clear that we're not getting anything from this. We have volunteered a tremendous amount of our time for this project, for these bragging rights, and it's a fun challenge. We're just very proud to be in the running.
So how much time did it take, or does it take, to get from idea to finished single proposal?
Yeah, we probably worked on this for about 4 months, I would say, from whenever they announced the brief of what the commission was looking for. We immediately hit the ground running with researching everything we could about our state, you know, the state bird, state flower, and really, you know, workshopping here internally with our team on what we believed would be the best representation of our entire state, regardless of where you live.
That's Bloomington Normal native Colleen Hayes and Scott Clannon, both of Clannon Creative in Champaign. Both are also Illinois State University graduates. Public voting on the finalist designs for a new state flag begins in January. Lawmakers will later decide whether to adopt a new state flag. Clannon and Hayes talked with Charlie Schlenker. It's the busiest delivery season of the year, and unfortunately that means scammers will be busy too. Home delivery is the most popular delivery method for people who plan to shop online for the holidays this year. And with delivery comes the risk of scams and package theft. WSIU's Brad Palmer talked about the issue with Better Business Bureau Regional Director Sydney Waters.
So you can be easily distracted because you may have a lot more things than usual coming to your home. And so scammers are really hoping that you'll just kind of not notice, and they can make you act without thinking during this time of year.
Let's talk about some of these common delivery scams that are being reported to the Better Business Bureau. Some already here locally, phishing texts or emails that look like official notices from delivery companies. What's this all about?
There's a couple of different ones. The one we're seeing a lot of, they contain a tracking link. So it's a message that has a link just kind of updating you, letting you know where your package is in the delivery route. Now, it's unsolicited, and if you get this, do not click it, because what it's doing is it's just trying to get you to click that unsolicited tracking link and download malware on your device. And, you know, if you remember when you purchase items, many times they have the option of downloading like an app, depending on what you use, UPS, whatever service, and you can just look at your tracking updates there. So that's a really nice way to do it, or just go back to your original purchase, look at the tracking that way. Don't click anything unsolicited.
Yeah. What are fake misdelivery tags? What does that mean?
Yeah, this one's really scary. So in another version of the scam, the fraudster will send you a text claiming to be a delivery person who can't find your home. And they want you to call them back and just give you or give them personal information about yourself. So, you know, they may even go as far as to ask things like, I need your credit card number for an additional fee on this delivery. So if any delivery person reaches out to you personally or tries to get you to call a number that they send you, go ahead and stop communicating with that person and contact the service directly and let them know what's going on.
And even once your package arrives, you have to worry about theft directly from your residence, right?
Yeah, and you know, this is kind of the old school delivery scam, unfortunately, but it still happens. And you know, the so-called porch pirates, they'll steal packages directly from your doorstep. And an interesting fact the U.S. Chamber of Commerce put out is a more than a fourth of consumers have had a package stolen. And it's a lot more common at single family homes than even apartments or condos.
One thing obviously to do is to keep track of your deliveries. And some of these services do a pretty good job, right, of keeping you informed of where your delivery is along the way.
It'll be much harder for them to fool you if you know what packages you're expecting from what companies and when. And use the original tracking number you received to check any status of your package that you want to know.
And if you happen to get a missed delivery notice, maybe attached to your door or whatnot, how do you go about examining it to make sure that it's real or if it's a fake?
You know, and I know this sounds like a lot of work, but it's definitely worth it, especially during the holidays. So to make sure that notice is legitimate, look for things like poor grammar, logos, and print quality that don't look quite right. And then also a quick and easy one is just kind of cross-reference the contact information from the company on their website and see if that matches the delivery tag that you have.
And why would it be a good idea or possibly a good idea to request a signature when a package is delivered?
So especially if you are going to be purchasing larger ticket items this season, just having someone there so you can avoid those porch pirates is a great thing to do. And, you know, sometimes this may have a small extra fee, but it really will help protect those expensive packages. You know, I do encourage you always to check out that scam tracker. It's on BBB.org. And, you know, just type today in there and see all of the scams that were reported today. Even if they're not in your area, some of them are phone scams as well. So it's just nice to kind of be informed and prevent losing any of your packages or any of your cheer this holiday season.
This month, communities across the country and the world celebrated Mexico's patron saint. We hear once again from WNIJ's Maria Gardner-Lara, who brings us the highlights of one celebration held in Northern Illinois.
Dancers just finished their homage to La Virgen de Guadalupe. Bells are attached to their dress. The sounds of joy trail them as they exit the sanctuary. Song is also a key part of the celebration. Three young men lead a portion of the serenade to La Virgen de Guadalupe. Some folks sit quiet in reflection. Others sing along. There's kids fiddling in their seats. Felix and Patricia's family are the main sponsors and organizers for this year's celebration.
Muchos lugares del mundo la festejamos y la recordamos que es nuestra madre, que ella siempre está con nosotros.
He says folks across the world celebrate her, and we remind ourselves that she is with us for the good times and the bad times. The festivities are being held at St. Peter's Catholic Church in South Beloit. It's about a half a mile from the Wisconsin-Illinois state line. Folks stand in the entryway in the filled church.
Aún así, este lugar está para reventar porque hay mucha gente.
He says this place is about to bust since there's so many people. Even though there's other places that are offering services, he says this church was first to establish Spanish language masses in the area and was the only church to celebrate La Virgen de Guadalupe. But over the years, congregations have followed suit. This is an evening service, which is a duplicate from the homage that began at 4 in the morning. Patricia says that's when they first sing Las Mañanitas, the traditional Mexican birthday song.
Bueno, yo para mí es como si venirla a despertar temprano, no cantarla las mañanitas para que ella esté.
She says, for me, we're like waking her up with song, so that she's content on her day. Just like when we sing the birthday song to anyone else, she deserves it. The song includes references to a new dawn, birds singing, and the moon tucked away. Felix says his dedication to La Virgen de Guadalupe was passed on to him from his parents and elders.
Ellos siempre dijeron, ella es nuestra madre, ella siempre nos va a cuidar, no importa donde vayamos.
He says, they always told me that she is our mother, and she will always protect us, no matter where we go. We're communities that come from outside of this country. We always have her with us, hand in hand. He says his favorite part of the celebration is when the image of La Virgen de Guadalupe first enters the sanctuary.
Yo me hago el fuerte porque es una de llorar, una emoción, recuerdos, emociones.
He says he plays tough during that moment because he really feels the urge to cry because he's overwhelmed with memories and emotions. After Mass, folks gather at the church hall for tamales and traditional treats. I'm Maria Garner Lara.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along and join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcast, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Jenna Dooley in this week for Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.